This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have as a return guest, a real good friend of mine, one of the leading journalists on the left, John Nichols. John Nichols is the Washington correspondent for The Nation, associate editor of the Cap Times in Madison. He's a contributing editor to In These Times, and I'm proud to say to The Progressive as well. And he's the co-founder of Free Press. He's the author most recently of a book we're going to talk about today. The book is called The S-Word, A Short History of an American Tradition, Socialism. John Nichols, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
It's great to be with you, Matt. I like how you did the title there, exactly as it was supposed to be said.
I love the book, and I highly recommend it to anyone who's listening to this program because it's so informative. But why'd you decide to do it, and why now?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I had been thinking for many years, going back to the Clinton presidency, that I wanted to write a book titled The Need of Socialism, the idea that a country needs to have a viable socialist alternative, has to have political groups, a party, but the word itself has to be in the dialogue to have a full debate. And I thought during the Clinton years it was missing, and that was damaging. And then we got into the Bush years, and people got so active in opposing Bush, blah, blah, blah. And then it was very funny. I was at an event down in Racine, Wisconsin, and every year I go speak, a Catholic nun down there has me come and do a social justice event. And I was walking out of it, and I had mentioned socialism in my talk. And a woman I knew, a friend of my mom's, who's a nurse, it was a couple of years ago, she came over and she said, "You know, sometimes I just get a tingle when somebody says socialist." And I realized, it's a funny thing, I realized there's a lot of people out there who don't think socialism's an evil word, but they also don't hear it enough. And so I decided, what the hell, I'll just go for it and write a book that puts it right in the title and starts to talk about it as an American reality.
Yeah, that's what I liked. One of the things I like so much about the book, John Nichols, and that is that you say it's not a foreign import, and then you make this claim for the book. This country would not be what it is today. Indeed, it might not even be were it not for the positive influence of social democrats, socialists, communists, and their fellow travelers. What do you mean by that?
Well, go back to the very beginning of the country, and this is one of the funnest parts of the book to do, was to look at the founders. And were there social democratic and socialist ideas alive among the founders? Absolutely. Simply no question. There are wonderful quotes from Ben Franklin about the redistribution of the wealth. But the key person I focus on in the book is, of course, Tom Paine. Now, anybody who tell you that we could have had America without Tom Paine doesn't know much about communications, because it was Paine, the journalist, who called America into being with his wonderful radical pamphlets. First, Common Sense, but then The Crisis. Now, many people focus just on those two, and they think, well, that's the Paine canon. But that would be a little bit like focusing on the Beatles, you know, like their first two albums. They did more. And Paine, I would argue, perhaps his Let It Be or his White Album, was a wonderful pamphlet toward the end of his writing career called Agrarian Justice, in which he laid out the framework specifically and with budgeting for an American social welfare state. And it obviously something you could extrapolate to other countries. The fact of the matter is Paine imagined Social Security. He imagined disability benefits. He imagined Medicare, Medicaid. And interestingly enough, he imagined the way to pay for it, and that is by seizing the property of the wealthy, taxing the rich, and redistributing it to the poor.
Yeah, I didn't know that about Tom Paine in that specific way at all. And you lay it out beautifully in that chapter with bullet points about, you know, just how current, you know, earned income tax credit is one of those things that you say he envisioned. And also his writing was just so beautiful, and that's, of course, what caught on at the revolutionary days.
Also, it scared the wits out of people because he was so influential.
This is the one that I like best. I mean, the first part is the famous part. We have it in our power to begin the world again. But the second part I hadn't remembered, which is, it's a situation that hasn't happened since the days of Noah until now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's the beauty of Paine, because he was sort of always calling people to this higher ground. And it's logical that Paine would get to economics. He begins with a revolution against colonialism, against empire, against imperialism, but quickly moves to, okay, how do we organize this thing? What do we do? There's many people like a Glenn Beck who will think that Tom Paine was anti-government. No, he was anti-King George, but he was actually quite in favor of government. He just wanted it organized in a small-d democratic way. And that became such an influential thing. After Paine died, virtually without respect in the United States, his funeral was attended by a handful of people, including it was one of the few integrated events in New York City. Some free black men were there to thank him for his opposition to slavery, but very small, very disregarded. But around the world, there, in the first part of the 19th century, tons of people referred to as Paineites. It was sort of a radical predecessor to what we would now call socialists. And the best of them, my favorite of them, I write about a lot in the book, is a woman named Fanny Wright. Mm-hmm. Fanny Wright was Scottish. And as a very young woman, she was incredibly precocious. Her dad was a Paineite. He read Paine. She had money. She was relatively well-to-do. And she wrote to all of the great revolutionaries of the world saying, I love, you know, the revolutions you were involved in. I love all the stuff you were. I'd love to meet you. I'd love to talk to you. Well, of course, the most, you know, kind of the big rascal of revolutionaries, Lafayette, still alive in his 70s. This is 1820, said, why, yes, my dear, why not come over to France? Let's chat. They got to be very close, whatever their relationship is a little unclear. But when Lafayette came to tour America on the 50th anniversary of the start of the American Revolution to visit all his old friends, Madison, Jefferson, et al., he brought Fanny Wright with. And this is an incredible lost part of our history because Fanny Wright, a passionate radical Paineite, who had read Agrarian Justice, spent 3 weeks at Monticello with Jefferson and Lafayette, challenging Jefferson on how dare you let the revolution wither? How dare you not push it further? Interestingly enough, following those conversations, Jefferson, in his last statements, issued some of the most radical statements of his life. And interestingly enough, also, Fanny Wright turned around, went to New York City, and became one of the leading spokespeople as a woman for what is broadly recognized as the first socialist party in America, the Working Men's Party.
And Jefferson was a fan of Paine's too.
Jefferson loved Paine, yeah. But he was sort of like Barack Obama's a fan of Howard Zinn. You know,
I hope it was better than that.
No, but it's that it wasn't always. Jefferson loved Paine. He loved reading him. He was very influenced by him. And yet, once he got very powerful, didn't always mention him. And Paine was a rascal. He was condemned by the New York Times for the terrible influence he had. Even into the 1840s, 1850s, the New York Times would refer to Red Republicans or to Paineites. These were people who, you know, took the revolution just a little too seriously.
I'm speaking with John Nichols. Of course, he's the author of The S-Word, A Short History of an American Tradition, Socialism. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Another chapter in your book, John, about the founders is about Lincoln, who's not really a founder, but one of the icons, obviously.
Watch out, get into that Michelle Bachmann turf.
Yeah, right. You know. Right. I don't want to be put in her category, God forbid.
Right. She's always sort of expanding the founders as far as she needs to.
But, and Lincoln, a lot of progressives, including especially Fighting Bob La Follette himself, was an excavator of Lincoln and an upholder of Lincoln as an egalitarian and as an anti-capitalist, as someone who sided with labor against capital. And so you also dust off some of those passages from Lincoln. Why focus on Lincoln so much?
Well, I think there's a reason why Lincoln books still tend to make the bestseller list. We are a country that's absolutely fascinated by our 16th president. There's an obvious reason for this. It's intriguing. You look at the timeline. Lincoln died a year after Paine died. He was born in the year that James Madison became president of the United States. And yet we don't think of him in that revolutionary moment. We really think of him as sort of, in many ways, the beginning of the modern American experience, first the Civil War and then what came after. So Lincoln becomes the critical transitional person. And what was his contribution to this country? It was a horrible one. He forced us, as any good friend would, to confront our greatest sins, and that of slavery, but also that of a maldistribution of the wealth and of a vision that capital was somehow more important than labor. This was an obsession of Lincoln's, and he spoke of it throughout his career, but especially once he came to power. And remember, this is a guy, Lincoln had read Marx, there's no doubt of that. He had read Horace Greeley's New York Tribune religiously. He was an obsessive reader, letter to the editor writer, and Marx was the European correspondent for the Tribune. And so he knew some of this terminology, and it's when you read Lincoln's terminology and you compare it to Marx and Engels, you will see parallels. That's not to say that he took it from Marx. It was of the time. There was a lot of discussion, but it's notable that we speak so much about Lincoln's his inaugural address. And it was a very powerful address, discussing better angels and such. But his first State of the Union address, when he was actually speaking of governing, given late in 1861, he spoke at great length about the Civil War, that there were literally guns trained on the Capitol, and you know, it's very all the trauma of it. But then he said, I would be remiss if I didn't take time out from this speech to talk about another concern that is at least parallel to and maybe even equal to our concerns about human bondage, and that is the terrible problem that we have where some people think capital is more important. He said, labor is always superior to capital. And then he goes on at great length about the importance of a fair distribution of the wealth, fair remuneration for your work. And you start to see Lincoln as who he was. Not, in my opinion, a socialist, but someone who had learned from and sampled from socialist, social democratic ideas and took some of them very seriously, most seriously, a redistribution of the land. And of course, one of his great domestic policy initiatives was the Homestead Act, which actually did give free land to the poor.
This view of Lincoln isn't one that a lot of people know. I mean, it's not one that we find in the high school.
It's one that some people hate.
And for good reason. But it's part of the reason that this book is so important, John Nichols, the S word, A Short History of an American Tradition, that tradition being socialism. And that is that you've uncovered this thread or focused on this socialist thread that runs through our history that many people have a vested interest and an ideological interest in not recognizing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to surprise a lot of people that thread is there, and it's going to inspire a lot, and some are going to get angry about it, but there it is. I mean, it's part of our history, and you stress the importance of knowing our history. Mm-hmm. Why is that important? Why don't you explain?
Well, I think we have to battle for our history. It's a constant fight, and we tend to think that fights only exist in the moment. But the truth is, I learned a lot from Tony Benn, who's a veteran British parliamentarian. He served 50 years in the British Parliament, a wonderful guy who could, in the midst of a speech, reckon back to the diggers in the 1300s and then bring it right up to the 21st century and high tech. But what Benn said is the great battle in any country is for its recent history. And that being the history of the last 100, 200 years. Remember, he's British, so they have a lot of history. And he said, because there will always be those who try to redefine it. The elites will try to redefine history, and they'll try to shave the edges off revolution. They'll try to soften our revolutionaries. They will try to make us into sort of a corporate state that, you know, made a business decision to break away from the British, or made a business decision to end slavery, or made a business decision to break the trusts. And so, you know, as Ben would always say, that wasn't the case. We have progress comes from radical commitment, radical action, and it is the job of the contemporary radicals to go back and recall it, to bring it up into the light, and to say, you know, if you want to change something now, you got to recognize that you stand in a tradition. And of course, the other person who influences our dear favorite Howard Zinn, who I think would have said almost exactly the same thing as Ben.
Yeah, you mentioned Marx before. Marx says ruling ideas are the ideas of the ruling class, but those aren't the only ideas out there, and we've got to get our ideas up there too. And also one thing that you say is, John Nichols, reminds me of just going through the old issues of the Progressive magazine back in the La Follette's day is, you know, they fought for things, the socialists fought for things, the communists fought for things that were called just the most outrageous and scandalous things at the time, but have become part of our lives, part of our social structure that people, you know, public libraries.
And public education, that's a very radical thing. And education for something other than to be a wage slave, to be a worker fitting into your space. And we have these battles to this day, in my opinion. But the interesting thing is that you mentioned La Follette, and I talk a lot about La Follette in the book. La Follette is a classic example of something I think is very healthy in the American experience. La Follette was not a socialist. He did not call himself a socialist. Yet he sampled regularly from socialist ideas. And in 1924, when he ran for president, the most successful radical campaign for the presidency in the modern era, probably since Lincoln, when he ran, he knew that he had to build a broad coalition. And so he not only accepted but sought the endorsement of the Socialist Party. And this is an important thing to remember. In 1924, Robert M. La Follette ran for president of the United States, got 13% of the vote nationally, millions of votes, carried the state of Wisconsin, ran second in most of the western states, carried Cleveland, Ohio. This very successful campaign as a candidate endorsed by and aligned with the Socialist Party. We shouldn't lose sight of that. We think one of the things that the left has done, which I think is very damaging, is to suggest that socialism never happened here, that it never got very far. What I argue in the book that there were moments when socialists were extremely influential and when they were winning elections for Congress, for mayoralties of big cities, being very viable even up to the presidential level.
Yeah, this is a great part about the book, The S-Word, A Short History of an American Tradition, Socialism, by my guest John Nichols, who's been talking right now. I'm Matt Rothschild at The Progressive. And that is the success of socialism at the grassroots, at the lowest level of government, at city government, at county government. And so you have a chapter on that. Sometimes has been derided as sewer socialism, sometimes applauded as sewer socialism. Explain the term sewer socialism.
It's one of my favorite terms. And I was blessed, as you were, to learn it from one of the originators, Frank Zeidler. And this is a former mayor of Milwaukee. He was mayor for 12 years till 1960 as a aggressively out socialist, would go on to be the Socialist Party candidate for president. And Frank always explained it and knew the actual story. Sewer socialism came to be a popular term or a much-used term in the 1930s. And it occurred when the Socialist Party convention was held in Milwaukee. Milwaukee was the great socialist city. The socialists had controlled it pretty steadily from 1910 on. And when all the elite intellectual New York socialists arrived in Milwaukee, all the local elected officials, much more successful electorally than the New Yorkers, people who were on the city council, the school board, the sheriff, the city attorney, who at that point was the father of Marcus Raskin, who would go on to be a Kennedy.
I wondered that. I saw the Raskin name.
Jamie Raskin's grandfather.
Yeah, sure.
All these officials, all they could talk about was Milwaukee's new sewer system. And the elite New Yorkers were like, well, what's this sewer? You know, come on, there's got to be – we need to talk about capital and all this. And the Milwaukee socialists, the reason they kept winning elections is because they understood that a sewer system mattered. It was public. It was created by the Commonwealth. And it made people's lives healthier, more functional, freer. And it's an interesting thing that sewer system that they talked about, and what the New Yorkers called them sewer socialists somewhat jokingly, that sewer system was so good, so successful, that Milwaukee throughout the 1930s was rated the healthiest city in America because, unlike most cities, they had cleaned up their water.
And for decades, it was considered the best-governed city in America. And it wasn't just sewers either. I mean, there was this real the mayor back there, Mayor Hone. Mm-hmm. There's a quote you have in this book, John Nichols, 1932. Mm-hmm. Right in the depths of the Great Depression, the mayor, socialist mayor, says 25,000 families must be fed this winter, and we propose to feed them if it's the last thing we do.
And they did. And you know what Hone did? This is an incredible thing. He made a deal with the farmers out in the region. Hone was actually from a rural county, and he'd come in and become a lawyer and then the mayor, to buy food. And then they set up because the grocery stores were charging too much. In the poorest neighborhoods, they set up they took vacant buildings and created city grocery stores, which sold food at cost. So the farmers would get a little bit of money, but made sure that everybody could get cheap food.
You know, it's interesting because I've long thought, you know, Michelle Obama talks about these food deserts, and I think municipalities should run their own grocery stores.
Well, this isn't very different from a CSA, what we would call a CSA now, working with the farmers or even a cooperative. But what Hone did was an immediate intervention because this is, and it's one of the wonderful things about American socialists. People say, what's the difference between a liberal and a socialist? I say, you know, liberals, if there's a hungry person, they'll say, well, we got to have a policy. We got to think about how to do that. The socialists, when they ran cities, they didn't say, we got to have a policy. We got to think about it. They said, we are going to do it. We will feed them. We will take the actions necessary now, and government will do it, and we will make no apologies for that.
One chapter you have in this book, John Nichols, the book is The S-Word, Short History of an American Tradition, Socialism, is about how socialism, how socialists became victimized by a repressive government and in the process of objecting to that and suing and protesting actually rescued the First Amendment from the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Tell that briefly.
Well, I have great passion for that story. Victor Berger, who was the editor of the Milwaukee Leader, a German Jew, who had immigrated to this country, very steeped in Marxist and socialist theory, the guy who actually introduced Eugene Victor Debs to Marx, to the reading of Marx. He was not a radical socialist. He was actually relatively moderate. But when World War I came, his newspaper, the Milwaukee Leader, opposed the war. The post office pulled its first-class postal privileges. That was a big deal because the Leader circulated nationally, as did most socialist papers at that time. They pulled that those postal privileges from other papers. It was an attempt to shut them down, to silence them. Berger was actually told by the Postmaster General, he's a former member of Congress, that if they just shut up about the war, he could get his postal privileges back. He said, I can't. The war is the issue. And so they tried to jail him. They fined him hundreds of thousands of dollars. He turned around, ran for Congress, got elected, and then the Congress refused to seat him because he was being tried for basically sedition.
By like 330 to 1, there was a ridiculous
Oh, it was terrible votes. And then he came back. They elected him again. He came back, and it was 330 to 2. But the funny thing was that he kept battling. And interestingly enough, he finally got it up to the Supreme Court, and he lost. But the dissents by Louis Brandeis and Oliver Wendell Holmes outlined a vision of free speech in wartime that exists to this day. And the bottom line is, if a Glenn Beck or a Rush Limbaugh wants to criticize Barack Obama in wartime, in these terrible wars in Afghanistan and Libya, wherever else, they are totally protected, totally free to say pretty much whatever they want because of law and principles really put in place and established by Victor Berger and the socialists, and also Eugene Victor Debs, who was jailed at the same time, during that incredible period from 1917 to 1922.
Another chapter in your book, John, is about A. Philip Randolph and Martin Luther King, too.
That's my favorite. Actually, that's my favorite chapter.
Why?
Well, because I think it's totally lost to history, and it's very recent history. The fact is that the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom was organized by A. Philip Randolph, the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. A. Philip Randolph was a radical socialist. He was called the most dangerous black man in America. He was arrested. He was briefly jailed. He edited a radical newspaper, which he identified, a radical magazine, which he identifies as the most radical magazine in America. And he was just a stone-cold, passionate socialist who fought at every turn throughout his life to force power to bend on the issue of civil rights, but because he believed it was an economic issue and that whites would not be free until blacks were. He forced the integration of the war industries in World War II, forced the integration of the military, but still the South remained Jim Crow in many northern cities, so he organized the March on Washington. The fact is that socialists were all over that march.
Bayard Rustin was part of it.
His great assistant. And there was efforts to red bait the march, to say, you know, you got to get rid of these people. And Randolph, you know, he held firm to it. And the interesting thing is the lost story of what he did after the march. He and his very close ally, Martin Luther King Jr., who, as I write about in the book, spoke very, very passionately about the need to explore social democratic solutions, came up with a budget for America, a people's budget. Amazingly enough, if you can imagine it, working with Michael Harrington and others, they debuted the budget at the White House. Lyndon Johnson's White House. And much of what became the War on Poverty was outlined by socialists who were not always listened to, not always, you know, given full rein, but were invited to the White House to give their ideas and even became advisors to the War on Poverty. This is not ancient history. This is within the last 50 years that socialists and social democrats were organized great marches, but also came into the corridors of power and in a very good way influenced how we addressed issues.
Why isn't that happening today?
I think that we are in the period of the most effective and aggressive red baiting in our history. And
more
I am
so
not,
than McCarthyism.
Yes, absolutely. Hmm. During the McCarthy period, socialists were elected mayors of Milwaukee, Bridgeport, Connecticut. Former socialists like and socialist allies, a big Norman Thomas campaigner, Paul Douglas, was the senator from Illinois. Other former socialists served in Congress. Red baiting wasn't It was anti-communist. It was anti and ugly. And I don't want to. I should be very careful. I don't want to diminish the Red Scare for its violence and its crude brutality, particularly to people who were involved with the Communist Party and their allies. But the word socialism was not as demonized then as it is now. And I think that the incredible thing is that there is a great fear on the part of elites, and political and economic elites, of this alternative and of this very viable alternative and the ideas associated with it. And I have to tell you, I spent a lot of time listening not just to Fox and to Rush Limbaugh, but also to other mainstream media outlets. And the way they talk about socialism is as if it is, you know, something just a shade away from Nazism. Mm-hmm. And I think that has had a damaging impact, particularly on the Democratic Party, and particularly on people like Barack Obama, who've run from the word.
Mm-hmm. You say worrying about presidents is pop politics, but worrying about parties is a more serious and necessary endeavor. So let's leave Obama alone. I've talked enough about him on this program. And talk about what vehicle do progressives use who are socialists and open about mm-hmm. being socialists, as I am. You talked about Michael Harrington. We only have 2 minutes left, and folks, I wish we had another half hour. And Harrington's theory was you join the Democratic Party, push it as the left wing of the possible. But you suggest that given what's happened with the Democratic Party, that may not mm-hmm. be the way to go. So what would be a way to go?
I knew Michael Harrington as a very young person, and I have immense respect for him. And he's all through this book in all sorts of very honorable ways. But the fact of the matter is he spoke about the left wing of the possible, and I'm not sure that the left wing of the possible still lives in the Democratic Party. That is a great open debate, and I think we have to be blunt about it. Money in politics is the issue. It has polluted both parties, and I think our discourse is exceptionally limited right now. We have as narrow a discourse as we have had in modern history of the Republic. We have X'd out all sorts of ideas, and if they cannot live in the Democratic Party, if the money power that it controls it at the top is going to push that out, then we do have to look at alternatives, whether they are third parties, whether they are independent political groupings like the progressive movements and the nonpartisan league movements of the 19-teens and 1920s, and also some of the independent progressive and socialist movements of the 30s that so influenced Roosevelt. Whatever route we go, I think we have to explore it, because we cannot have a functional debate, or I would argue a functional society, if we continue to X out huge portions of the debate. If we say some ideas, some ideologies just can't be discussed. We've got to get these ideas back in. And what I've found from going on talking about this book is people are ready for it. I don't care what, you know, I tell you, I know there's elite media that can't get it. I know there's elite politicians that can't get it. But there's a hell of a lot of grassroots Americans who are more than comfortable with saying that, you know, if it's socialist idea is a good idea, that's fine by them. And if a social democratic idea is a good idea, it's fine by them. Bottom line is they want those ideas in the mix, even if they're not socialists. And we ought to have political movements that help them to get that.
And the polls bear that out. A Pew poll had 30% of the people having a favorable view of socialism, and young people having a more favorable or equal favorable view of socialism as to capitalism. So, John Nichols, we're out of time, but thanks so much for being my guest today. John's new book, The S Word, A Short History of an American Tradition, Socialism.
Thanks, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.